Special guest Christopher Garantano with me tonight, who made the Montauk Chronicles and many other things single-handedly. Is there a differentiation between the first and the second one you made, or you just calling it Montauk Chronicles and going with that second one?
Well, there's a difference, but I've only shown it to a few people between December of 2011 and I guess towards the end of 2012. I kind of threw it away. So it's a completely different movie, and I guess that, you know, I just consider the whole journey making the film, even though I remade it from top to bottom. The one that's out in the world is Montauk Chronicles.
You'll have to excuse me. I kind of mentally spaced. I meant Dark Files and Dark Montauk Files. Chronicles. So you guys can check out Dark Files on the History Channel. And how can people see Montauk Chronicles if they want to stream it or buy it from you?
Okay, you could buy it on Amazon.com or from my website, MontaukChronicles.com, or you can rent it or purchase the download at VHX.com.
Okay, awesome. So I'm just going to jump right into the questions here. I've looked at Montauk for a number of years, and I watched The Dark Files, and I enjoyed it incredibly. What physical evidence do we have of just the Montauk boy part? What can we kind of take home and verify outside of testimony there?
Okay, so outside of people who I think are credible after all of these years, certain people, some of them I don't believe are. I think they're either taking advantage or they're not exactly who they say they are. Outside of that, I think physical evidence, what we have, is the data that we collected at the end of the Dark Files. So let's say the photos of the alleged acid houses that Brian Minnick found, they actually took, and the footage, you know, because that's a structure that's no longer there. It's gone. It's obliterated, and now it's, an area where picnic tables are. And, no one's ever going to see it again. And as far as I know, there really isn't any other footage of them. So Brian's stuff is the best. And that's evidence, because that was brought to people who had worked with psychoactive drugs and psychedelics. And some of those people, so-called experts, but they are experts, professors and people who have studied it for years, people who worked with Timothy Leary, they felt that there was something there. Now, Barry Eisler, who is my co-host on the show, he also felt that it was quite curious, and so did Steve Volk, who is deliberately skeptical, and I think for a good reason, because he studied so many things that he just didn't hold water. So all three of us unanimously agreed that this was evidence. This was something. This was evidence of an experiment that's not supposed to have taken place there, and also those structures have been knocked down. I don't know, for the very purpose of just completely covering up the fact that those rooms in that house were deliberately and professionally painted. They were odd patterns, and so experts agreed that those patterns were used in experiments. Okay, and we have the smoke of legend surrounding the place saying that there were experiments there, coupled with speaking to people who lived on the base in the 70s and said, this is way before any books were published by Preston Nichols, that there were talks of secret things going on at the base. So I would say that was the first part of evidence. The second part of our evidence that was gathered was through a group of geophysicists called GeoView, and they were originated in Florida, and they came up, they were hired for our show, and they used something called electronic resistivity imagery that basically saw deep beneath the ground and took a vertical slice of information and showed that there was an enormous structure just underneath and within that vertical slice. An enormous structure meaning about 25 to 30 feet down beneath the surface was the roof of this structure. And then another, perhaps, remember this is just one vertical slice, perhaps maybe I think 50 feet down from roof to floor. And that it was also covered the entire expansion of, I think, maybe 60 feet wide. So they really just grabbed one little tiny slice. And I think I believe 100% that's evidence, because we're told over and over again that there's nothing there. There's nothing under the ground whatsoever. Well, this is proof that there is something there. And this wasn't a tunnel. This was something much larger than that, which is in line with everything that's been said, that there's an enormous structure underneath the ground, an underground base that is not in any of the plans or blueprints that are available to the public, or any of the existing blueprints, period, that we were able to find. So someone's covering this stuff up. Here's the other thing that you didn't see in the Dark Files. It was in earlier cuts. I'm not exactly sure why it was not used in the end, but we didn't use it. So there was a day where we showed up. This was a scheduled day on our permit. We had to get a permit. It's History Channel. When I worked alone, I didn't have a permit. I was everywhere I needed to be.
Sure.
But with a crew of this size and a network like that, you have to get a permit. So they knew where we were going to be on each day. And so there was this enormous operation from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in a rainy, cold winter day on the same exact day that we're there. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is there in droves, drilling right near the tower. They have botanists and they have field scientists and all these people just scouring the grounds. Interesting, right? Just for the same day we were there?
Certainly, yeah, certainly.
It just seems like there was an enormous effort to keep us away from certain parts.
To have things like botanists on a day when, you know, the conditions just didn't make sense to be looking at plants and all of that just seems very confusing to me. So we have evidence of a cover-up. We have evidence of what certainly seems like experimentation that we can even sort of start to divine the taste or the direction of, as far as, you know, those who at least worked with Timothy Leary, you know, saw things that were recognizable. And then we have separate legend of these boys and these kids being taken off the street, or we're just sort of logically putting the two together. As far as I see it, we don't necessarily have the evidence that the boys were taken there, or that there were Montauk boys, but everyone's testimony certainly specifies, you know, just things about that, along with a lot of other colorful stuff. But one of the things that seems consistent is the idea of, you know, turning these unwanted, undesirable, no one would miss them type boys into Manchurian assassins or some flavor of super soldier.
Sure. And now, okay, there are two other things that are of interest to me. One more was that the geophysicists found another plot of land. This plot of land we were not supposed to be at. It was a day that we called a rain day officially to the people that were we were being watched the whole time by the people who issued the permits to us. And they really gave us a hard time, which was strange, you know? We weren't even allowed past the fence, whereas there was a lot of maintenance guys just kind of mosey on past that fence all day. There's kids hanging out there all day. Here's the difference in the equation. The difference is those kids and those maintenance men did not have the geophysical equipment that we had, and I think that's what they were afraid of, that we actually had stuff that could see underneath the ground. You know, you can have explorers, urban explorers there all day. They're not going to have that geophysical equipment unless they invest the money, and a lot of these people will not do it. So if you can get that electronic resistivity imagery or hire geophysicists to come down, that's when you're going to start to see a huge resistance, which is what we saw. Now, one of the places we went to it was mentioned in the show, but I want to clarify exactly what Mike from GeoView told me, is that it was very similar to a mass grave sites that he had seen in the past. What he said on the show was it looked like a lot of decaying organic material and disturbed soil, many different places. And in private, off camera, is what he told me was that it was kind of, you know, very similar to a mass grave site. He says, I'm not saying they're bodies, but I'm saying that that's what it looks like to me. Or it could be that, for sure.
Sure.
But I don't think he wanted to go there. So that's one thing. That's another thing in addition to all of this and the resistance they were putting up. Plus, I had another thing, and I really tried to get this person on the show. And I was contacted by this person after I was on Coast to Coast AM. They heard me on the show and they needed to speak to me. This person worked for a major chemical company. And, you know, I always wondered where the money came from for this thing. You know, who funded it? And so they worked for this major chemical company between 1970 and, you know, even much later than the 80s. And right now they, you know, they have a pension and they got cold feet last minute. They were going to speak with their identity obscured, but what they said was that they witnessed a lot of documents with information that corroborates this, you know, the story in general in regard to Brookhaven Labs, in regard to Camp Hero, that this company was sending a lot of things their way, money, experimental alloys, all sorts of things during a time where the base was supposed to be, you know, inactive. So why is, and why are Brookhaven Labs and Camp Hero connected? That's just supposed to be part of the legend, you know?
Sure,
so,
yeah.
And I trust this person. This is real information. This person has a lot to lose. And I sat and spoke with this person many times, and they're not doing it for attention, I can tell you that much, or anything else. They didn't do it. They didn't speak on camera. But I know this for a fact. I know this. That, you know, I had the conversations with this person, and there was a special military gentleman that was appointed to this person. This person had a secretarial position, and basically their fear was they're gonna narrow this down and figure out that it is this person, because right. No one else worked with this guy in this situation, and that's what they fear. You know, because if sure. We could find out where the money came from, I mean, you know, it's proven. So it's
so
all of that.
Jumping over into legendary, just for clarity or to be thorough, there's no official connection between Brookhaven and Montauk, but Al Bielek spoke of a levitron, underground connected way of getting back and forth. Yeah.
Yeah, it was an underground transport, train that would hover above the rails. Which is, I guess, a real thing, no? I mean, I had read that this was being developed and to be applied in not only Japan, but in California. And this was years after Al. I heard that from Al for the first time. I had never heard that before. And when I talked to, I sat with Al in Fort Myers, Florida in 06. He mentioned that. It was called a Leviton train. I think that's the term he used. Mm-hmm. And he said, yeah, there are many of them. But there was one that went from Brookhaven Labs to Camp Hero, and that's how they got to work. They didn't.
So kind of like a Disney monorail running through what conspiracy theorists refer to as the dumb, so the deep underground military bases brought forth by Richard Sauter and the name's escaping me right now, but the other fella who, you know, was just going on a talking circuit talking, almost had it, the underground bases.
Correct. And why, you know, and again, like, I don't know why it's so difficult for people to believe this. And the reason why it was really important to remind people that there were things like MKUltra and, of course, the Holmesburg prison experiments that we also showed on the Dark Files is that that was a real thing. And it wasn't just these chemical experiments. There were mind control experiments there. So it's like you get to a point. And, you know, in your research, you're a very thorough researcher. You know that you're at a point where once you read about all these other things, you're like, well, honestly, there's not a part of me that doubts this. I just want to find out what parts of the story I've heard are true. And that's where I'm at. It's like, what parts are true? You know, things get embellished along the way in a lot of these things. And, you know, I'm not going to believe everything everybody says, especially when, you know, they have major price tags attached to tell me that they met Jesus Christ or, you know, they were, you know, they hung out with aliens and all that stuff. It's like, I'm very cautious of you if you're charging me $5,000 to tell me all that stuff.
Sure.
And I mean, then on top of it, tell me how to think and tell me how to, you know, eat. And it's like, that's right. Some dangerous stuff. I'd be really careful with people like that. So,
yeah, that actually leads to a later question. But just to note real quick, you know, before coming across Montauk or really coming across it with any serious scrutiny, just the activities of Ewan Cameron at the Allen Memorial Hospital in Montreal in Canada, and mental driving and the kind of furthering of Mengele's techniques and the atrocious ways they were experimented on, you know, unwitting, unknowing patients who might have just showed up, you know, with a tummy ache or a headache and wound up, you know, completely mentally
somewhere
incapacitated, led me to believe how easily these things can be implemented at Montauk and then furthered, you know, to an electronic level and things like that. For those out there who might not believe, you know, this kind of stuff is possible, do you see a connection between, or what is the connection between, because there seems to be one, between Montauk and the MyLab phenomenon as far as the use of underground bases, the use of mind control techniques? Have you seen a connection there, or am I just kind of painting a bridge where there is none thus far?
No, I mean, you know, I would think there's a connection, because I don't think all of these were just independent of each other and coincidentally of the same ilk. You know, I think there's some kind of mainframe to all of this, don't you? You know,
sure.
Of course there's a connection. I think there's a connection between all of these, between Holmesburg Prison, between Montauk, between MKL. I mean, there's a direct connection. We just don't know exactly what it is yet, but I think it's pretty obvious that there was a major, there was a brain, you know, a master mind behind all of this. And perhaps it started after World War II with Operation Paperclip, maybe way before that. There's just a lot of things that are muddying the waters here. And a lot of it has to do with, in my opinion, you know, the crap that comes out about, and again, I'm not saying I don't believe in the extraterrestrials, and I don't believe in psychic abilities. I just think that it seems to be, to me, that there are quite a few profiteers off of that aspect, and they only want you to focus, whether it be for disinformation or, you know, they're just trying to make a few bucks and they're having fun. They see people that are gullible. I mean, I've heard things come out of these guys' mouths, and there are people who were like seemingly of sound mind and really nice people and very intelligent people, and they'll just believe whatever these guys say. And I, you know, I'm like, hold on. You know, after the Vietnam War, there were a lot of people that, or many wars, but after the Vietnam War specifically, there were several writers that came out, journalists or whatever, guys that claimed that they were in combat, guys that claimed that they had these extraordinary experiences, later to find out that they were stationed in California or weren't even in the military. So I think it's a situation like that. You know, you've got some people that know or a little bit about this stuff and are now saying that they were part of it.
Do you think there's dangers to this is obvious in this point in the conversation, but do you think that there's dangers to approaching the camp of, let's say, Swerdlow or Nichols naively? Is there danger to a newcomer finding, you know, a religious purpose in following just them and their curriculum?
Yes, because now you're submitting yourself. You cannot submit yourself to anybody. I mean, I have people I truly admire, like Alejandro Jodorowsky. Like, I think he's a great guy. I've studied his stuff, watched his movies, read his comics, read his books, but he's not my guru, you know, and he doesn't want to be. This is a man who will give you the tarot readings for free if you end up in the same cafe in France. I would be very careful of anything that anybody tries to get you to do sexually with them. I don't give a hell, goddamn, whatever they try and tell you, you know, what the reason is. I've heard the reasoning coming out of their mouths. It's all for deprogramming purposes. It's just like a medical procedure. Listen, if it's sexual in nature, these guys are predators. 100%. You know, they should be not passing these techniques along. You know, they should not be applying these techniques to people in covert situations. They do not have any credentials. They do, you know, it's like, I just, it's, and it seems to be like a slow draw in, like a spider to a fly. You know, you have this web and it's glistening in the light, and then you know, a moth or any other kind of insect gets caught in it, and that's the same type of deal. These guys are predators, and I'd be really careful of them putting their hands on me. I mean, look, the first day I met Preston Nichols, and I think Preston's a nice guy, but he was still trying to get everybody into the chair naked. You know, the guys that were with me, the first time I met him in 06. And I have footage of this, and it's like, I'm not, you know, pointing fingers, I'm not accusing, but how does this go from I just met you 10 minutes ago to now, okay, now I'm going to put my hands on your genitals? It's like, I don't care what your reason is. It's not happening. And so, unfortunately, there have been other people in these situations that buy into it and say, well, now these, and I think somewhat damaged people, now these people are going to save me because they're offering all this wonderful, you know, this way to get deprogrammed, right? You're like, I'm going to take away all your problems. I'm going to take away your depression. I'm going to take away all of this. This is, listen, this is classic manipulation stuff to get you to do something. I don't know if. I just wouldn't trust it, you know? And again,
I mean, it's very intelligence organization cult setup based. And it's also very based in asserting a spiritual or psycho-spiritual authority first, that, you know, I'm a priest or I'm a Hollywood mogul or I'm the only person that can unlock the psychotronic vibrations that the shadow government has, you know, done to you. And so then once you believe that I have this spiritual authority, even over things that you never understood before, other dimensions and other beings, I make it more and more complicated. I make the depth completely unswimmable of getting from what you thought the universe was about to what I'm suddenly asserting it's about. And I have authority over this. I'm saying that there are reptilians and I can sit you in a chair and beam a microwave at your head and, you know, fix your childhood sexual trauma problems or whatever. And then after that spiritual authority is asserted, it just seems to get super creepy and super direct after that, regardless of what the avenue is, whether it's one of these people leading a YouTube cult or whether it is a priest or a Hollywood mogul, you know.
Of course. And it's, again, it's, I've experienced, and again, don't take this the wrong way. I've experienced firsthand because as an observer, of course, never participating, but had, and I didn't see the actual act of this, but I know it happened because the person who said they did this admitted it to me. And I actually have it on camera. And they tried to, I don't know, it was almost like this kind of, you know, subliminal suggestion that, hey, I do this, but it's to heal you. And it's a medical procedure. It's like, no, it's not a medical procedure. And it was, you know, so I guess it was kind of almost being advertised to me at that very first day that I met the person. And I'm like, well, you just met someone who actually has strength in their mind, you know, in their soul. I'm not going to give into this stuff. You know, it's no way, not a chance. So, you know, I would just, I'd be really careful of anybody that's trying to deprogram you in any sense of the word, or even just make any adjustments to the way you think. You must think for yourself. And unfortunately, a lot of these people will say, well, I'm just helping you think for yourself. It's like, no, you're not.
Right.
So
I guess they figure the more alternative the curriculum, the more, you know, what we would call new agey or whatever, the more they feel like they're free from the usual constraints of narcissism, power, and sexual dominance. But that's pretty juvenile of them. I don't know.
Very. And that's something I noticed, that it's almost like they're completely juvenile and unaware of what's going on around them. And I think they're so surrounded by very good people, but damaged people that are looking for a father and a mother. And, you know, people to worship and people to follow. I'm not a follower, you know, like, and so I noticed all of this. And again, some of these people are just such good people, the people that are being, in my opinion, victimized by a lot of these people, that I would just be really careful. Now, you know, there's some good people in the field too. There's some honest people. They're using their abilities to heal. I think whatever catalyst they use to help heal people, as long as it's not devious or felonious in nature, then I don't see any harm in it. You know, just like seeing a priest, if the priest isn't trying to take advantage or whatever, thing, it's all a catalyst for energy created, you know, so positive energy. So it's not all bad, but the people that I've noticed are, so certain people in these groups.
Yeah, and I definitely agree. So I heard your explanation for the following and agreed with what you said. And I got to speak with Peter. I'm sort of friends with Peter Moon, have been for years. I had him here on the show. And I enjoyed his books, But I agree with you that it's sort of this wonderful, you know, sci-fi trip through all these exotic ideas, and it's, you know, jumping with both feet all the way over the crimes and some of the horrible dark stuff that's insinuated by the very program and the very nature of Montauk. Yeah, I'm talking about Peter Moon's books.
Yes.
But why was Peter Moon left entirely out of the dark files? I just wanted your explanation for my listeners.
Honestly, I don't know, to tell you the truth. I know Peter was interviewed, and he apparently gave a good one, and they recorded it, and it made it into earlier cuts. See, that's the thing. We had another woman, Jolene Seebacher, really great interview, and she talked a lot about being a Plum Island girl. So she had information about this, and her interview was excised. And we also talked to a U.S. Marshals psychiatrist. That was excised. I mean, look, you shoot 300-400-plus hours of footage. You have to edit it down to a program that's less than 2 hours. You're going to lose some things. We, you know, the production spent a lot of money to go to these people and interview them. We didn't lose the interviews because they were bad. It's just part of the editing process. And, you know, by the end of it, I think a lot of people got upset and took it personally. It's like, you have to understand, you know, I've worked on projects that just didn't work out. And I just, you know, it's the nature of this business, unfortunately. And sometimes things get dropped, and it happens in the editing. And that's my best explanation. They didn't single out Peter to cut him out. It was really trying to race getting notes from, you know, I mean, like, you have editors, you had the producers, which I was one of them, giving notes. Then you had the network giving notes to the production company. So it's really just so many people saying, oh, what about this? What about this? What about this? And then racing to make a deadline. And I know this from working on the inside, that it had nothing to do with anything else.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that makes total sense to me. For the listeners, just so you guys know, Peter said that he was addressing some of the concepts and some of the science or the quantum physics behind time travel and some of those ideas. I don't know if he's talking about the Merkaba and sort of the human meditation body that can sort of astral travel through time, or whether he's talking about Andrew Basiago level, you know, sort of jump rooms or trip chairs used to travel time. But I do know that if you look into Peter Moon's websites, he has a lot of sort of seminars and talks and things he gives on that. And those explanations are there. And his books are a colorful amalgamation of all these occult and conspiracy ideas. And I suggest them for anyone, you know, interested in the topic. The female voice that you heard when you were 12, 14, how old were you?
I was about 14. Yeah, that really happened.
14. Are you familiar with Valis and Echo and these kind of female voices that come through phone lines or psychically that inform people of?
I've heard about the tech. Well, I see now, I don't know. Is it psychically, or is it somewhat like just tuning into some kind of signal, or actually tuning into you? Like, is it more advanced technology than that, or is it a psychic projection? Because I've heard about advanced technology sending those things, but I'm not extremely well versed in either of those. No.
Well, it just caught me because the way you were explaining it, because, you know, I think it was in 1974. Robert Anton Wilson, Philip K. Dick, Hal Puthoff, Jack Sarfati, all these different people had contact with this female sort of Gnostic, all-knowing intelligence. And with Jack Sarfati, he got like phone calls from an electronic female voice at his home. With Philip K. Dick, he just like sat on the couch and had a sort of revelatory experience and was suddenly had these giant downloads of information that seemed to be coming through a female voice. In my own both combined ritual magic and sort of forced chemical sleep paralysis, I managed to contact this thing, or contact the same sort of idea. And it sounded like radio state. It sounded like a woman coming over radio station to me. It wasn't words that I could make out, but it seemed like she was just casually speaking to someone else or something, and I was somehow privy to it. And I just, all those experiences, I almost bring up in every show. And I was just seeing if somehow, you know, it related to what had happened to you.
Again, when I was a kid and for many years after, I thought I was listening to a ghost. After exploring these programs and the technologies behind them and the reasoning behind them, I am certainly considering that what I heard when I was 14 was something else, perhaps. You know, when you're a kid and you don't, you know, you have a limited amount of knowledge of the paranormal, supernatural, and especially at that time, it wasn't really in vogue to be into conspiratorial things outside of JFK or whatever. Sure. So at that time, I really didn't know anything about this, and the internet wasn't even, you know, nearly what it was in the early 2000s. So, I had a profound experience. Thinking about it now, it's just clear as it was the day it happened or the night it began. And it could be, you know, I mean, think about if I start thinking back and then this entire timeline, and then you're being irresistibly compelled to continue for 11 years with no money and no pay, making these movies, working on this stuff, you know. And it wasn't until recently that I started doing it professionally, you know, like actually doing it for a living. But it was just something that was pushing me through. I don't know. It could be, you know, I just don't know. Why is it that these communications are happening with everybody? Or are people targeted or singled out? Was I singled out for a reason to hear this stuff? Did I stumble upon it for two nights by accident? I don't know.
It seems to be with all of the people I just mentioned, who heard the voice, and certainly myself and certainly you, it seems to be people that are compelled to get a message out, who are the master of their domain in some field, that winds up communicating much larger spiritual concepts and ideas. And that goes from people working in intelligence agencies all the way to, you know, Philip K. Dick, you know, just people, sci-fi authors and people, scientists who had CIA contracts but were interested in more spiritual things. And that brings us into another sort of realm where, by the time this happened to you and to all these people, they had already, you know, published the patents and worked on the technology to sort of beam a voice into your head and later develop a way to make that voice seem like it was your own conscious voice. And then we get into modern psychotronics and, you know, what that means to the military and those agencies today. So that's sort of the conspiratorial side of it. But there's also this weird Gnostic spiritual matrixy simulation theory side to it, which doesn't seem to connect to the conspiracy or the intelligence agencies at all. And it's all very curious to me. But I don't have any more answers, certainly.
No, I wish I could further examine what happened. I mean, it's so interesting to me. And again, I'm leaning more towards what we're discussing at the very moment than it being some kind of haunting, you know?
Yeah.
So, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, definitely. Okay, let's see. So, out of all the tales that you've heard, and all the testimony and everything, I guess just, can you give us a rundown of the different types of aliens? And if not all the different types, just some significant things they seem to have done in the program or been related to the program for.
It seems to me, and again, all of my information about the actual aliens comes directly from talking to Alfred Bielek, to Preston Nichols, to Stuart Swerdlow, to James Bruce even. And, you know, then there's this whole secondary and tertiary groups of people that I spoke to over the years. But the guys that I spoke to for many years, the ones I just mentioned, the main guys, they said there was everything from, you know, a variety of gray aliens. You know, Preston describes them as hook-nosed grays, small grays, big grays, the grays that can, you know, like in, you know, the Dreamcatcher, Stephen King's The Dreamcatcher. It seems like King, much like Philip K. Dick, is a prophet. You know, either that or and I'm going to offer this, is that I'm also well-versed in science fiction cinema and television of the 20th century and literature, and so are they, you know, because it's whenever I talk to Al Bielek or whenever I talk to Preston Nichols, and of course Swerdlow, they are all avid readers of science fiction, and in some cases, of course, classic television like The Outer Limits, movies like Forbidden Planet. You know, these are names and titles that came out of their mouths while they were using references, Star Trek references. So the reptilian creatures were referred to by Preston Nichols as the Gorn from Star Trek. I think the episode, what was it, called Arena? Something like that.
Yeah.
Okay, so the original Star Trek series. And then, you know, there were just so many Outer Limits and Twilight Zone episodes that were being referred to. And, you know, there was even a villain that Swerdlow he ran into called Hans von Gruber. That's the villain from Die Hard. It's like, come on, guys, I've seen these movies too, you know.
Right, right.
So, yeah.
It's weird because, you know, in studying the media and then studying the intelligence and DOD influence on the media when it comes to aliens, and then listening to all these guys talk for all these years, it's really crazy because they do go from, like, technical scientific explanations, things they're telling you about military projects or whatever, to directly just breaking down and saying, you know, this thing from Star Trek, or directly like this technology or this species from Star Trek. But then in studying all the media, you know, Doctor Who, Star Trek, Star Wars, Stargate, they all do have the Egyptian god equivalent alien, the reptilian species alien, and the sub-reptilian, the Greys and their scientific experiments, the genetically concerned, you know, whatever overlord comic booky villain alien. I mean, and they all those shows have those separate things, and they all have the, you know, it's redundant because they all have the same type of, let's say, archetypes when it breaks down to the difference between reptilians or humanoid future time traveling.
Sure. Look at John Carpenter's They Live. You know, I mean, right. We could keep going and going and going.
Yeah, it just goes on forever. Yeah. So what came first becomes impossible. And, you know, perhaps that was the purpose of injecting that into the media when the DOD or CIA or whatever, or Air Force decided to in a particular case. And then there's things that just seem to melt together between fanboys of this sort of conspiracy and the direct influence of military, like in the X-Files of Dark Skies. So it's a bizarre world trying to pick that stuff apart,
it,
you know?
It really is, and that is why there's something very different about this. I felt it from day one, you know, because I could have decided to make my next documentary about, and this was before I made Montauk, of course, I just finished a movie called Horror Business, and then I was moving on to a new subject matter, and I wanted to do something in the world of the supernatural, and I was obviously always interested, but I wasn't, this was all new to me. This is like this really, you know, kind of cold military experiment with the science fiction candy coating around it to conceal what's really going on. And that's really how I feel about it. Like, all of this other stuff is around this horrible, murderous, you know, sexually abusive, you know, mind manipulation program, but it has this candy coating of aliens and monsters and time travel and all that stuff wrapped around the surface of this really dark sphere. You know, that's what this is.
Which is very present in, oh, I'm sorry, what?
That's what this is to me.
Yeah, for sure. You know, it's very present in Stranger Things. We can't really avoid not saying the name of the show, the whole interview here. And it's weird because it's like in Stranger Things, a person watching it trying to figure out, okay, somebody told me this is based off a real story. Well, it sort of breaks down around, like, you're listening to Preston, you're listening to Al Bielek, and for me, it kind of breaks down around the Bigfoot idea and the summoning of the beast to, you know, to valiantly knock down
it's
the project
that
they suddenly decided was a moral problem after, you know, engaging with kids on a daily basis who were beaten and raped, and, oh, we're just reprogramming their mind, this is all fun Stuart's Wordlow stuff, and then suddenly we're the good guys, we have to throw our bodies onto the gears and stop this machine, you know, and do the right thing, and we have to do it by manifesting Bigfoot from a psychic child or a psychic person's unconscious. And then once that translates to Stranger Things, Bigfoot becomes the villains and the imagery from Silent Hill or, you know, any number of fictions or video games where there's a equivalent to the Upside Down and someone's getting stuck in and out of another dimension, and that dimension has eyeless plant inspired goblin beings. And so then you're watching Stranger Things and you're saying, okay, government project, the CIA is using the cover of the DOE, the Department of Energy. Well, that's like them using a front company or a cover company, you know, that's factually coherent. Okay, they're mentally driving these children, they're interested in psychic children, they're you know, locking them away without any sensory input to later experiment with them in the sort of beyond the black rainbow way. I mean, we see this trope repeated over and over.
There was a novel written years ago by an author named Dean Koontz called Watchers. It was later made into kind of a schlocky horror film about a government program that had a psychic dog. And there was a junior created also that was psychically connected to the dog. And it was very, when I first heard of Junior, I'm like, these guys read Watchers. You know, and this was made years previous, well before the book came out. But it's definitely curious, you know, it could be that, again, everything at its core and the dark pitch blackness of it is this really horrible program that is affecting everyone. But, you know, the guys that were running the show said, look, we have to create some stories around this thing. So, of course, they're picking from popular culture. Or it's just something that's been going on for thousands of years and we're completely in the Matrix. You know, like, but I just don't want to believe that. You know, I just don't want to.
Yeah, I mean, I hear you, but I also see it repeating. You know, I was mentioning to you that the dark, terrible narrative at the core of this thing is, you know, this classic ancient initiation, right? And so when we deal with Dulce Base and we deal with Montauk, we're dealing with bringing someone underground, you know, in the torch lit naked darkness to, you know, beat the sense out of them, beat the normalcy out of them, and sort of kill them to have this, you know, rebirth process of being born some sort of psychic super soldier. And people listening to the story and people watching Stranger Things will begin to just cut away and probably avoid and not understand things about the Silent Hill nature, the Upside Down, or the creatures that lie there within. And when you're listening to the stories of Al Bielek and Preston Nichols, you're going, okay, underground initiation, right? This is the CIA doing what they did with MKUltra, using the same drugs that would be used for initiation for the same process. And then we get Bigfoot, you know, and then we get this red herring that starts to throw us in a totally different direction and makes us question the whole thing. You know, is there even a Montauk? Is there even a Dulce? Once we start considering things like Bigfoot running around, not hurting anybody, but, you know, breaking the test tubes and freaking out everyone enough that a diehard intelligence agency would just be like, oh man, this is too much. Let's just stop. It's bad.
and it's true. Yeah. It's surrounded in this almost deliberately bad science fiction story, you know, like deliberately bad. Like, how could you not know unless you guys had, you know, Rohypnol and wine that night, you know, it's like,
right.
I always felt that way. When I read that story, I'm like, how could these guys not know how terrible this story is? You know, how ridiculous it is. And it also has a major contradiction in it. So the story, the heroic meeting in room one of the Memory Motel, Think about that for a second.
Memory
it's a
motel.
Top secret government program. These right. guys are there apparently against their will. According to them, this is like, you know, they were mind controlled too, all of them. So right. how on earth did they get out of the base, go into town for lunch without supervision, meet in Memory Motel, and then come back? And the contradiction is they weren't allowed outside of the base. They went from Brookhaven underneath the ground to Camp Hero underneath the ground. So what are you guys doing over Memory Motel?
In Area 51, and just to repeat, the Memory Motel, for crying out loud. In Area 51, and with Lockheed, with Skunk Works, and all these different organizations and companies that work on special access programs, and particularly on acknowledged special access programs, or USAPs, as Stephen Greer and now Tom DeLong talks about. There's this idea, you know, that, and pretty factually proven and pretty well documented, along with the documents, including the blueprints to some of these advanced craft and some of the older guys who worked there. You know, when you're working for those agencies, first of all, you go on a plane with blacked out windows. You can't really see where you're flying. You get on a bus with blacked out windows. You can't see where you're driving. And the guy working on the left wing of the plane isn't going to be able to go to the cafeteria and have lunch with the guy working on the right wing of the plane. I mean, it's that compartmentalized. So then when you're dealing with something this psychotic and this off the radar, and the extent to which you would classify such a thing, taking MKUltra and its sub-projects, which we hardly know about, as an example, you're right. You know, how the hell would they break away to, you know, like in some movie scene, you know, meet in a bar and be like, hey, you know, tomorrow we meet around 12 and everybody bring part of the machine and we'll connect it to the thing. And, whatever.
It's just a bunch of bad storytelling. You know, like it wasn't well thought out. It's like it was really kind of thrown together. You know, I mean, like what was it, Jay Anson? Kind of, and the lawyers of the Amityville Horror Story with the Lutzes claim that, you know, the story was embellished over a bottle of wine or several bottles of wine. I actually believe in some of that story, you know, only because the Lutzes kind of took it to their grave and the kids experienced things too. But outside of that, you know, not to completely go off the track here, I think that's kind of what happened. These guys, you know, Preston was in the psychotronic group for psychotronics meetings for many years, and I just from gathering and thinking about this for a long time, it just sounds like they had stories to tell. They were embellished, and when the book was decided upon, and then all of that stuff was there. Or these are just implanted memories of what these guys truly remember. They really remember meeting up in the Memory Motel. Like, this is just a concoction of the people behind the actual program, not Preston Nichols and not Alfred Bielek or Duncan Cameron, that this is what they truly remember, even though it's probably unlikely that it actually happened, you know, those parts.
Sure. And a great example of that, you know, flourishing in this field right now is Andrew Basiago, who, you know, I'm not saying here that I know what the dude actually went through, but I do know that there's a process that I've been observing with military abductions made to look like alien abductions, where they inject the extremely fantastical to throw the story out of the water. So not only does a person not get to nail down exactly what's being said about the Greys or the mantis beings within the craft, but now there's this other element, so we never ever question if there's a human or a military element. And with Andrew Basiago, who's an extremely intelligent, extremely well-structured person when he speaks, you know, and he has credentials out the wazoo. He believes he went to Mars and with a bunch of other children and was time and age regressed in the way that people popularly understand Corey Good was. But where it really throws the story off the tracks, regardless of who you are, is that Obama was also a child and sort of a young adult handler of the rest of these children on Mars. So you're trying to swallow a way to travel to Mars You're trying to swallow that we would have sent kids there for whatever reason, and that they're walking around the earth today as people regressed at a completely different age and a technology we don't even understand. And then you're supposed to throw in, you know, a president who already has, according to the silliest of conspiracy theorists, sort of a shady past or background that can't really be figured out. Well, you know, he was on Mars with Andrew Basiago. That's what makes Basiago seem laughable. And then the jump room seems laughable. And then everything about the Total Recall reality of the Philip K. Dick, you know, concept of getting to Mars and the secret shadow government being there or whatever becomes that much more silly when trying to look at it from any direction, you know?
Of course. Yeah. And I've thought about this, and I've thought about everything that everyone's ever said, and I've been completely and totally fair, and I've tried to find as much information on all of it as possible. But my instinct tells me, you know, everything I've said previous to what I'm saying right now is the truth. You know, I think people try to think very black and white terms, and it's not black and white. This is a very, you know, organic thing. And so, in other words, there are liars involved, just flat out liars, people that met these people along the way and just jumped right in and decided this is going to be their new con. Okay. And I'm sorry, but people have to face it. You can't just believe somebody never in my life, if somebody knocked on your front door and said, hey, if I can come in and, eat your food and sleep with your wife and, hang out in your house for a while, you're going to be a very, very rich man in 3 days. You're going to have millions and millions of dollars. And on top of that, I know Jesus Christ. It's like, you're going to let this guy in the house, right? Because he's telling you the truth and it's worth it. So it's very similar to what these guys are doing. Or some of them, I should say. I'm not going to discredit other good people, and I haven't fully figured them out yet, but some people I have, and I think they're taking full advantage. So,
yeah, absolutely. And you know, the people telling the story might even have a bunch of legal things they're worried about, so they stick to a ridiculous script if they in fact were some handlers and the shadow government does have dirt on them, and you know, they were just told to go out and spread the story and enjoy living the rest of life because that's all they'll have. You know, I don't know the deals made, but we have to wrap up the show abruptly. Please tell everybody, all of your work is excellent. Everything you've done is so passionate and so thorough and so incredibly brave when stood next to everything that's been done so far. I don't know, just adventurous, just it's amazing what you've been able to do. Please tell everybody where they can find all your stuff.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. You can find my stuff on my website. It's my website, montaukchronicles.com. You can send me a message, say hello, or you can go to Amazon for my movie. Or I think, and I don't own the Dark Files. History Channel owns it. And we will continue those adventures, by the way, and we're working on it now. But the 2-hour special that aired on the investigation into the Montauk Project, you can find, I believe, on Amazon, on iTunes. It will re-air on History Channel USA, and it's premiering in the UK on November 26th, Sunday at, I believe, 8 p.m. or 9 p.m. in the UK, coming right up.
Awesome. Well, all right, everybody, thanks for tuning in, and have yourself a good night, and thanks for being with us, Christopher.
Thank you so much.
All right.
All our toys, they let us think that we're big boys, they let us make a lot of noise. can follow us on our website, spacedoutradio.com, on iTunes and TuneIn. Follow Dave on Twitter at Spaced Out Radio, on Facebook at Spaced Out Radio Show, or on our YouTube channel, Spaced Out Radio Show.